The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
She had been monarch since 1952. Today, the legacy of Queen Elizabeth II.
It is the longest reign in British history. So anybody who's been born since 1952 has only known one sovereign.
Also today, some Colombian lawmakers want to lower their own salaries.
Yo creo que cada senador tiene
this lawmaker took to YouTube to say it's not fair for public servants like himself to live so comfortably while many Colombians suffer. Plus, tennis has an emerging new American superstar, but Francis Tiafoe isn't just winning over the fans at the U.S. Open in New York. West Africans are loving it too.
This has been one of the dream of myself and also the millions of children around Africa who aspire to play tennis and other sports.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. Queen Elizabeth II, the longest reigning British monarch, has died at the age of 96 after more than 70 years on the throne. Buckingham Palace announced the news early Thursday evening UK time with a short statement. The Queen died peacefully at Balmoral this afternoon. Balmoral Castle is the royal residence in Scotland where the Queen had spent most of the summer. British Prime Minister Liz Truss said the nation is devastated by the news.
Queen Elizabeth II was the rock on which modern Britain was built. Our country has grown and flourished under her reign. Britain is the great country it is today because of her.
Elizabeth became queen in 1952 with the death of her father, King George VI. Now her son, Charles, is the new king. Orla Barry is the world's Europe correspondent and joins me on the line from London. A monumental day, Orla, in British history. What's the latest there?
Yeah, there's a real sense of shock here that the Queen has actually passed. You know, we had been expecting this in a sense, Marco. She's a 96-year-old monarch and she's been there throughout most of our lifetimes. In fact, she's been through now 15 prime ministers. She appointed the 15th prime minister only 2 days ago. She's outlived 12 US presidents. But to hear that she's actually passed was still a bit of a gut punch. And it feels like a watershed moment for Britain. Already this evening, we have thousands of people turning up at Buckingham Palace. That will swell to hundreds of people this evening, I was looking, but that will swell to thousands as the hours go by. Mm. There's an official notice posted on the railings now of Buckingham Palace announcing her death. People have also gathered at Balmoral, where the Queen has spent the last few months, Balmoral Castle in Scotland, and all her family are there this evening. And also all the flags and government buildings there at half mast. They all went down about 10 minutes after the announcement this evening.
Tell us how this historic day played out, Orla. I mean, the first alerts came earlier today when doctors said they were concerned about the Queen's health and were closely watching her. What happened after that?
Yeah, we got a statement from Buckingham Palace at about 12:30 today to say doctors were concerned. And this got everyone talking because it's pretty unprecedented. You know, the palace so rarely comments on the Queen's health. And then news emerged that Prince Charles and then Prince William and Prince Harry, that they were all heading to Balmoral to be with her. And at that point, everyone knew it was pretty serious. I should say, mind you, if anyone was watching the BBC today, and indeed all the news channels here, all the presenters have been wearing black all day. And that really is unusual because I've worked in the BBC for many years and I know it's protocol to switch to black when there's a death in the royal family. But to wear it before the death is even announced was completely unprecedented. And it did indicate that the BBC knew that she probably only had hours to go. Since then, we really have only had rolling news coverage of the Queen on all our news channels. And that's the way it's going to stay for some days to come.
The Queen was a very public figure, that's obvious. But as you point out, Orla, her health has always been considered a private matter. What do we know about her health over these last several months?
We know very little, actually. It's a good question because mobility-wise, we know she had mobility issues. And we know that because physically you could see her sometimes walking with a walking stick or walking with two sticks. And we know she didn't move from Balmoral to Buckingham Palace, for example. They blamed that on mobility. But other than that, we actually don't really know. You know, when she had COVID, for example, all we heard was that it made her feel tired and we heard nothing else. There was lots of presenters speculating, royal correspondents speculating what her underlying condition could be today. But, you know, she was 96. It could be a range of many things. And even tonight, Marco, we don't have details of what caused her death, just a brief statement from the palace saying that she passed away peacefully.
The British monarchy has plenty of critics in Britain. Lots of people there will say they're not royalists and proud of it. But in some ways, Queen Elizabeth II sort of rose above some of this deep skepticism about the royal family. What was it about her and her rule as queen that seemed to win over so many people?
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, even talking to people sort of younger and older of different generations today, there is a real sense among them of an era coming to an end. You know, she has been there throughout our lifetimes. And many people are saying today that they feel a sort of a sense of poignancy, I guess, in a sense of a historic event, if a sad occasion at that. She's this sort of stoic figure, I guess, who has witnessed everything from World War II right up to Brexit. As I said, you know, she's seen so many prime ministers through office, from Churchill to Boris Johnson. And in a way, she rarely put a foot wrong. She sort of embodied the role, the job, and her life were one of the same. And she was also a bit of an enigma. You know, she's a hugely private figure. We really didn't know that much about her. And she rarely made gaffes like her children, and I guess her grandchildren, have made over the years.
So an official period of mourning now in Britain, that's for the next 10 days. Tell us more, Orla, about what happens in these coming days.
That's right. There will be around 10 days of mourning. There's a whole elaborate schedule that kicks in. It's known as Operation London Bridge. That's the official title of it. But it doesn't mean that everything shuts down for 10 days, but there will be a series of events in motion that involve the royal family and Parliament, etc. Her body will be moved from Balmoral to Buckingham Palace, and then she will lie in state in Westminster Abbey for 3 days, and then members of the public will be allowed to go and pay their respects, and that will continue for 3 days. And expectations are that hundreds of thousands of people will turn up in London for that.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thank you very much, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
To help us put the Queen's reign into context and what comes next, we reached out to Jonathan Spangler. He teaches European history at Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK. Jonathan, before we talk about succession, this is, to say the least, an historic day in the UK and around the globe. The news is very fresh. Your reaction to this moment that we all knew would happen eventually, and now here it is.
Yeah, I think you've put it exactly right. It's been something that I have known would happen very soon, but still, when it then actually did happen, earlier today, it was a bit shocking. And I think that people all over the UK are going to really need several days to process, and all around the world, because I think one of the key things to remember about the reign of Elizabeth II is the importance of the Commonwealth throughout. And so Canadians, Australians, et cetera, are really going to be thinking a lot about what the monarchy means to them today.
Right. Well, the rule by Queen Elizabeth II has been multi-generational, so many people in Britain and around the world have not actually witnessed a transition from one monarch to another. What is involved in that?
That's right. It is the longest reign in British history, and very nearly the longest in any monarchy's history. So anybody who's been born since 1952 has only known one sovereign. The rules were laid down about the succession quite early on. So it's been primogeniture since the Middle Ages, and it's been fairly settled about the right of succession since the 18th century. So it will go immediately to the Prince of Wales, who is now the king. So it means that the succession is instantaneous. That's the magic of monarchy. That's the ceremonial. But then the actual coronation will probably take time to prepare and present.
And the transition itself, do you see it as a seismic one, or will it be as straightforward as what Britain has seen in decades and centuries past?
I think that this is a crossroads, a potential turning point, more so for countries like Australia, who have already been kind of thinking about becoming republics over the years. Within the UK itself, there are a significant amount of people who would like to transform the country into a republic, but they've never really been that huge of a group, and they're not that vocal. So it's really hard to know. People love tradition in the UK, and this is at the heart of tradition.
So after the death of a monarch, how quickly does a new head actually ascend to the throne?
The tradition has always been for royal heralds to say, the king has died, long live the king, implying that it is instant transformation. This goes way, way back into the deep, deep Middle Ages, where the whole idea was that monarchy was continual and never died. And so the spiritual element that makes a human being a monarch would literally move from one to the other in the blink of an eye. So whether we in the modern world kind of believe all that is up to individual belief.
What's your sense of what Queen Elizabeth II's legacy is going to be? I mean, that transition from kind of empire to Commonwealth, is that kind of at the top of the list, or is there something we're not thinking about?
I think on the longer term, that will be the thing. Bringing Britain through a very dark period, which was the late 1940s, early 1950s of post-war austerity. And a lot of people really, really see the monarchy as something that held the country together and kept it quite stable. There, of course, are dissenting views who thought an institution like monarchy that's hereditary kept Britain back from entering the modern age.
Queen Elizabeth rarely expressed views on politically sensitive questions. Is a new monarch likely to keep up that tradition?
That's often a question that people ask about Charles and the idea of how would he be as monarch? Because unlike his mother, he has expressed lots of opinions, and sometimes they're strange or deeply unpopular. But I do believe that he knows the role. He's trained for it for over 60 years. And I think that there is a very careful line to be tread right now, particularly in the West Indies. And it will remain to see how well that's done.
How has opinion of the royal family changed in the UK in recent years?
It's been a long, interesting, twisting tour almost. When the Queen ascended the throne and then was crowned, I think there was just no question about loyalty. It was something you simply did. And I know a lot of older people who are now in their 70s or 80s can't really fathom anything different than that. But in the 1960s and 70s, that really started to change, and a lot of people questioned the role of the monarchy, its intense privacy, and so they tried to be a bit more public, sometimes got it very wrong. Then, of course, there was the rocky 80s and 90s with divorces and the death of Princess Diana. But I think since the turn of the millennium, there really has been a resurging of interest in the royal family, and the Jubilee this past year really kind of showed, I think, that people really were still quite interested.
So, I mean, supporters of monarchy and dissenters in the UK, but Queen Elizabeth II herself as an individual, what role does the Queen occupy in British culture?
That would be the one thing that people can say for certain, is that whether you like the idea of monarchy or not, I think everyone appreciates the work and the devotion and the dedication and just being a good all-around role model that the Queen has been since the 1950s. So that's really this amazing continuity. After this death, we will then have to see whether people still feel this same kind of loyalty, and maybe divisions will arise.
Jonathan Spangler teaches European history at Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK. It's very good to have you with us today. Really appreciate your time, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure on this very momentous day.
Join us for more coverage tomorrow. We'll be looking at how Queen Elizabeth II will be remembered across the British Commonwealth and in former colonies. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Kyiv, Ukraine today. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a surprise visit to Ukraine today. He announced additional funding for the government there to help in the fight against the Russian invasion. In a statement, Blinken said, "We will support the people of Ukraine for as long as it takes." The World's Daniel Offman is on the line with us from Kyiv. Tell us about this unexpected visit today from Secretary Blinken, Daniel. What was on his itinerary?
So this was Secretary Antony Blinken's second visit to Ukraine since the start of the war. We've seen photos of Blinken visiting a children's hospital here in Kyiv, a hospital that treats kids who have been injured as a result of the war. Blinken visited U.S. Embassy staff here in Kyiv, and he also met various Ukrainian government officials, including Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky thanked Blinken, the Biden administration, and Congress for supporting Ukraine's economy and providing it with military aid. Finally, Secretary Blinken's big announcement was this, that the U.S. is providing an additional $2 billion package of military aid, which is meant to bolster Ukraine's security and the security of another 18 countries in the region.
So $2 billion, that's in addition to assistance pledged by the Biden administration earlier this year. What does it all add up to?
So this is a significant package, but let's put it into context. Back in May, Congress passed a bill that designated $40 billion of military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine. And before that, in March, Congress approved a $13.6 billion emergency aid package for Ukraine. Since then, the U.S. government has been sending that assistance gradually. So this most recent package, the $2 billion that Blinken announced today, is part of that pile of cash that's already been designated for Ukraine. So far, the U.S. has provided about $13.5 billion in military aid, and that aid is used directly in Ukraine's military effort on the battlefield across the front line.
Daniel, what are you hearing from Ukrainians about this significant financial support from Washington?
So many Ukrainians that I've spoken with over the past couple of weeks have expressed gratitude that the U.S. is supporting Ukraine with military aid. At the same time, though, it's been Volodymyr Zelensky's strategy and his administration's strategy to put pressure on all partners, even the U.S., to do more. In some cases, Ukrainian officials publicly call out countries that are moving too slow or who are not, in Ukraine's view, doing enough. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has called this a shift in Ukraine's diplomacy. He said that this strategy is led by President Zelensky's style of communication, that is, being direct and frank about Ukraine's needs and not tiptoeing around conventionally more powerful countries. So the bottom line here is that Ukraine's position is to loudly praise countries that they call friends, countries that do what they want, and call out countries that don't. Perhaps not the most diplomatic approach, but it has yielded some results for Ukraine.
And finally, a note on the war itself, Daniel. About a week ago, the Ukrainian military reportedly launched a counteroffensive against Russian forces. What do we know about that so far?
So Ukrainian officials say that this military operation is well underway. They say their forces have recaptured territory in the northeast in the Kharkiv region. And then today, Marco, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, spoke about this. He confirmed that Ukraine's counteroffensive is ongoing. He didn't give a lot of details, but he said this. He said, quote, "The war is not over, but so far the Russians' strategic objectives have been defeated."
Well, given the price tag so far, hard to imagine after 6 months how he would characterize the war any other way. The World's Daniel Hoffman in Kyiv, Ukraine. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
In Colombia, poverty rates rose during the pandemic. Last year, when the government tried to raise taxes there, big protests broke out across the country. Now, some politicians in Colombia want to take voluntary pay cuts. They say it's time to show some restraint and be less disconnected from the people they represent. From the capital, Bogota, Manuel Rueda has more.
Atención, mucha atención. Yo soy J.P. Hernández y les pido que pongan mucho cuidado a esta noticia.
At age 30, J.P. Hernández is the youngest member of Colombia's Senate. Before he was elected this year, Hernández wasn't really involved in political parties. He made a name for himself and a living with his YouTube videos, where he criticized corruption and wasteful government spending. Now, as a senator for the center-left Green Party, Hernández is proposing a bill that would reduce the salaries of Colombia's members of Congress by 30%. He's also trying to convince them to forgo some of the luxuries they get from the government, like bulletproof cars and brand new iPhones. And he's on YouTube once again to get out his message. Hernández says it's unfair for public servants like himself to live so comfortably, while so many people around the country are struggling. I know that lowering the wages of legislators will not fix Colombia's problems, he says. But we also know that these high wages bother people, and we want to send a message that we're here to do things differently. Most workers in Colombia currently live off the nation's minimum wage, which is around $250 a month. Members of Congress get a monthly salary of $8,700. It's one of the largest gaps anywhere in the world between the wages of politicians and what regular workers make. Political scientist Jan Basset says Congress's image has already been tarnished by multiple corruption scandals, and the high salaries make things worse.
It's something that exacerbates the bad popularity of the Congress. It's not the main problem, really, but it's something that crystallized the public opinion against the members of the Congress.
But convincing political leaders here to take pay cuts has been an almost impossible task. Left-wing Senator Gustavo Bolívar says that over the past 4 years, he's proposed three different bills to reduce the salaries of Colombian legislators. None has succeeded. I've had colleagues tell me they need the money because they have to pay off debts from their campaigns, Bolívar told his followers on YouTube. He adds that many others simply abstained from voting on salary reductions, saying it posed a conflict of interest.
Con el argumento de que ellos no podían legislar en causa propia.
Now, Bolívar is proposing a less ambitious plan that would reduce wages in 2026, when a new congressional term begins.
Entonces tenemos que hacer una conciliación.
The only way we can get this done is to cut a deal with the majority, he says. But Hernández insists that it's possible to change things now. To put pressure on his peers, he's turned into YouTube and other platforms, where he has almost 2 million followers.
Señores, Colombia, ustedes van a conocer cuáles.
He's published lists of those who endorse the bill in order to embarrass politicians who don't.
Como usted ya nos puso en el escarnio público, me dijeron algunas congresistas.
There are congresswomen who told me they were against my bill, he says, but they endorsed it anyways because they said I have exposed them to too much public scrutiny. If Hernández succeeds, Colombia would become the third country in South America where legislators have recently taken pay cuts, after Chile and Ecuador. While his bill is debated, Hernández says he'll donate a third of his salary to charity. And he's already posted a video on YouTube that shows him traveling by boat to an impoverished Colombian village, where he donates boxes of food to dozens of people who live in small wooden huts.
No me importa que me llamen populista. No me ofende.
I don't care if they call me a populist, Hernández says. I will continue to do what is convenient for the people, what the people are expecting of us. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Some 10,000 people from sub-Saharan Africa are stuck in Tunisia. They're refugees registered with the UN, waiting to be resettled in Europe or North America. Only a few of them will get there.
Overall in the world, it's less than 1%.
How the other 99% get by in Tunisia without a job or a home. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Within a few months of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, reports started trickling out of so-called filtration camps. These are sites in Russian-held parts of eastern Ukraine where Ukrainians are being detained, questioned, and sometimes beaten and tortured. A team at the Yale School of Public Health has been on the case. They're using publicly available satellite imagery and open-source information to identify more than 20 of these detention sites. Nathaniel Raymond is executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. A note here that this interview covers topics that are not appropriate for all listeners. Nathaniel, first of all, who has labeled these places filtration camps? Because the phrase feels like doublespeak, as we'll hear, and belies the insidious nature of what you've uncovered.
The headline here, Marco, is that this is not just filtration camps. It's a system of civilian detention that involves four different types of facilities. Only one of them can be called camps. The other types of facilities are registration points, interrogation centers, and long-term detention facilities, better known by the word prisons.
And what is the purpose of these centers?
The stated purpose by Russia and its proxy actors is to identify potential Ukraine-aligned combatants within the civilian population. But the fact of the matter is that an untold number of civilians, men, women, children, are likely in the hundreds of thousands, are being held, some of them in incommunicado detention, in facilities where no international monitor, such as the Red Cross, has been able to access.
So who are the Ukrainians then being detained? Men, women, children, and how are they detained?
Well, it depends on what part of the filtration system they are being held in. At the Olimvika prison, we have both military-age men, civilians, being held in one part of the facility, while POWs from the siege in Mariupol are being held allegedly in other barracks. And we see what appears to be consistent with individual or mass graves being dug in April, and then another set in July behind the barracks where the POWs were allegedly held. And the set of apparent objects consistent with graves occur at a time where released prisoners from that civilian population also held at the facility claim that there was grave digging going on at the time. In one case, we see a mixed population with credible allegations of half of that population, the POWs, allegedly being tortured and, in some cases, potentially buried.
So talk, if you would, Nathaniel, about how satellite imagery and publicly available information is able to tell you all this. How do you interpret that?
By basically cross-corroborating both the actual words and claims, but also the metadata between photographs of, say, for example, a farmer's market that became an initial registration and apparent holding facility. We were able to take ground photos in other cases of schools, which often are these initial registration points, and then combine that together with satellite imagery to get what we call a pattern of life that helps us bring those pieces of data together to create a fuller picture. And we also have the real secret sauce in the recipe here is Telegram.
The social media platform, yeah?
Exactly. That information allows us to do a lot of cross-corroboration that then helps us tell a story with imagery that we otherwise wouldn't be able to tell. We are collecting constantly large amounts of online information and translating that from Ukrainian and Russian. And it's really what we call the mosaic effect. What is clear is that a story is emerging of hundreds of thousands, we don't know the exact number, of civilians going into a system with credible allegations of torture, unsanitary facilities, lack of food and water, overcrowding, and the story is told by the people who are released. What is most concerning, Marco, is what we don't know.
So your group at Yale has partnered with the State Department to document war crimes and other atrocities committed in the war in Ukraine. How is the information you're gathering going to be used?
In two ways. It is going to be used for accountability, including the International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice, and Ukrainian domestic accountability mechanisms. Second, it's being used in real time right now, publicly and behind the scenes to inform policy and to inform actions that are going to help protect people in real time. We are working around the clock, literally, on new reports.
What has been the Russian response to the information you've gathered?
They've called us fake news, Marco. I have the statement right here from the Russian embassy in Washington. And my response to being called fake news is, if our report is fabricated, as they claim, then open up the filtration sites. If there's nothing to hide, let the Red Cross in.
Nathaniel Raymond is executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. His team is using satellite imagery and publicly available information to identify detention camps in eastern Ukraine. Nathaniel, thanks very much for explaining what you found.
Always good to talk to you, Marco. Have a great day.
Over the past decade, Tunisia has seen a lot of migrant arrivals from sub-Saharan Africa. In most cases, people are fleeing difficult economic conditions and violence. Some of those migrants had been working in neighboring Libya, but left because of the civil war there. Among that group are nearly 10,000 refugees registered with the UN. Many of them are stuck in Tunisia. Because of their status, they can't legally leave for another country. But it's also difficult to put down any roots in Tunisia. From the capital, Tunis, reporter Lilia Blaise has more.
In a northern suburb of Tunis is a shelter set up by the UN High Commission for Refugees, a five-story building freshly painted. There, I meet with Hanan, a refugee from Sudan. For security reasons, and because all refugees are in a vulnerable position, she can't give me her last name, and I cannot provide many details about her life story. She left her country in 2015 because of war. I used to work when I was in Egypt and Libya, she says, but then I came here and discovered the problem of the language, she adds. Here, everything is in French, and we studied English, so it is difficult. When she arrived in Tunis, she was housed in a temporary UNHCR shelter in the south of the country. The usual procedure for vulnerable asylum seekers. She could not find a job, so she joined a sit-in with other refugees last January. The sit-in continued in Tunis, in front of the headquarters of the UNHCR. Hanan stayed with her two daughters and more than 200 refugees in the streets, day and night for 3 months, demanding to be resettled in another country. I refuse to go back to Medellin in the south, she says. We have spent the time waiting for the UNHCR to help us, but they gave us no solution. Now, she says, she's staying in another shelter in Tunis, but it is only a short-term solution. It is true that the center is a shelter better than the streets, but there are still problems. We are 10 people using one bathroom. We are suffering here, she says. I hear a similar story from Awadeya, a 30-year-old woman from Sudan, who wears a long yellow dress and matching head cover. It is hard in Tunisia, she says. There is so much exploitation. My husband and I, we try to work in construction, but we were exploited. Sometimes we don't even get paid and we can do nothing about it. She also experienced racism from Tunisians living around the shelter. Some people here were beaten. One of the guys of the shelter got his hand broken after a racist attack. They tell us that this is not your country. This area is very difficult. Women cannot leave the shelter. Next to her, waiting to receive food coupons from shelter volunteers, is Abdelmonem, a 16-year-old from Eritrea. He says he experienced violence in jail in Libya before landing in Tunisia. In July 2021, we arrived in Tunisia in a boat while trying to reach Europe through Libya, he says. There were 127 people on the boat and 23 drowned. I had like 5 relatives who died in that trip. They rescued us after multiple hours at sea, and we were burned by the gasoline. Like most of the refugees or asylum seekers in this center, he wants to leave for another country. My dream is to go overseas, he says. In Tunisia, there is no dream. You live here scared and humiliated. For UNHCR, it is difficult to fulfill these requests. Laurent Raguin is a senior program officer with UNHCR.
We will look at individual cases one by one, or look again and counsel them what are the options. The options are not many, it's very clear. The option is to try to be included in the society here in Tunisia and to try to become self-sufficient.
As many refugees told me, integrating into Tunisian society is difficult. The other option, Raguin says, is resettlement, a specific program run by countries like the US, Canada, and some in Europe.
But for these people, these are only very vulnerable people who will be taken for resettlement. And this is the number is very, very small. Overall in the world, it's less than 1%.
Last year, only 76 asylum seekers in Tunisia were resettled in another country. There is not much Tunisian authorities can do because there is no asylum law here. Ramdan Benamour is in charge of the Tunisian Forum for Economic and Social Rights, a watchdog on migration. Benamour points out that Tunisia is one of the very few countries still rescuing migrants at sea.
Il faut que l'Union européenne et les États membres assument leurs responsabilités.
The European Union and its members have to own up to their responsibility, he says, by helping the work of NGOs who rescue migrants from shipwrecks and transfer them to safe harbors. Despite Tunisia's efforts, people are still dying in the Mediterranean. 1,200 since the beginning of the year. And those who are rescued and brought to the Tunisian shore end up stuck in limbo with all the other migrants. For the World, I'm Lilia Blaise in Tunis.
Under a new law in Spain, tens of thousands of long-abandoned mass graves are slated to be dug up. The unmarked sites are a legacy of Spain's civil war and the brutal dictatorship that followed. We're talking a half-century of conflict and repression that ended in 1975. Few of the bodies of people killed during that time have been recovered. That's because the Spanish government chose to leave the dead where they lay and move on from that tragic history. But the so-called Pact of Forgetting has been unraveling in recent years as victims' families seek answers and closure. Jerry Haddon reports from northeast Spain.
Standing by a series of unmarked graves on a hill near the Ebro River, Jessica Flores grieves for a man she never knew, her grandfather, Andreu Flores.
Desconegut perquè no ni el seu fill, que era el meu pare, no el va conèixer.
He was a stranger, she says. Not even his own son, my father, knew him. All we have are a couple of photos of him with our grandmother. She almost never spoke of him, she says, except to say that she loved him so much. Yet Andreu, born in 1908, has occupied a spot at the very center of the Flores family for decades. It was a taboo subject, Jessica says, because my grandmother remarried. All we knew was that we had a grandfather who'd been killed in the Civil War. But as to where, she says, we had no clue. But in 2018, Jessica's aging father submitted his DNA to a new regional database of war victims. This year, there was a match. Andreu's remains were among 177 victims buried here behind an old stone house used as a field hospital. It was the summer of 1938. Andreu died of a head wound in one of the war's bloodiest clashes, the Battle of the Ebro.
When es produeix la coincidència...
The match to Andreu and one other were celebrated here this summer at a commemoration. For decades under the dictator General Francisco Franco, this was illegal. But then in 2007, decades after Spain had become a democracy, the government said, wait, most of Franco supporters were returned to their families and buried. This forgetting has been imposed on the losers.
Principios comunes como el reconocimiento de la dignidad de las personas.
In 2007, Spain passed the Historic Memory Law. Socialist Vice Prime Minister Maria Teresa Fernandez said at the time Spaniards share common values, such as recognizing the dignity of all people. The new law, she said, supports this by establishing new rights. Those rights included permission to dig up your dead. The catch, though, you had to do it yourself. The government offered some funding, but that was it. Now, the Spanish government is going further. Its new Democratic Memory Law makes the government responsible for exhumations. Spain's political right is furious.
Que hoy el Partido Socialista de Sánchez va a aprobar la memoria o la ley de la desmemoria.
Today, the government is passing a false history law, said Iván Espinosa of the far-right party Vox. Vox is the third largest party in Spain's parliament. Espinosa said the new law is another attempt to divide Spaniards. He said it would dynamite the pact that allowed for Spain's democratic transition back in 1975. Much of Spain's political fighting now is about how the country's past is remembered. Under the new law, Franco's former regime has been declared retroactively illegal. Anyone caught exalting the dictator could face a fine. But the law looks past Franco as well, investigating state-sponsored crimes committed after Spain's first democratic elections. Still, what's drawn the most attention with the new Democratic Memory Law are the unmarked graves waiting to be exhumed, tens of thousands of them, like Andreu Flores's near the Ebro River. The process is still fairly new, so when Jessica Flores got the call this year saying her grandfather had been ID'd, she was incredulous. But more than anything, she says, I felt joy. Joy that we'll have his remains, that we'll be able to lay flowers, knowing where he is. That is, in a cemetery near Jessica's father, who gave his DNA but died before the match came through. And next to Jessica's grandmother, the woman who would only ever say that she'd loved Andreu. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, near the Ebro River, northeast Spain.
Tennis has a new rising star. American Francis Tiafoe is winning over the crowds in New York at the U.S. Open. He stormed into the semifinals, taking out tennis legend Rafael Nadal along the way. Tiafoe was born and raised in Maryland by parents who emigrated from Sierra Leone. Now his success on the courts has fans across the world excited, especially in West Africa. Joining me to talk about all this is Sam Jallo. He's from Sierra Leone, a former pro tennis player and now coach of the game. He's currently in Liverpool in the UK. Sam, how exciting is it to have a tennis player with a background from Sierra Leone reach these levels of success at the US Open?
Absolutely amazing. And this has been one of the dreams of myself and also the millions of children around Africa who aspire to play tennis and other sports. And to also have Francis beating Rafa and getting into the semi-final now, and also see that his parents are from Sierra Leone, which is amazing. That just uplifts my spirit, and also in Sierra Leone, because today I've had a lot of messages from children sending me messages and said, Coach, have you seen the Francis Tiafoe, how amazing he's doing? And this is not just kids from Sierra Leone, but also, you know, from the Gambia, from Nigeria, from other places, you know, where I also go and help the children with tennis. So it's been amazing. It's a fresh breath of air to see that Francis is doing so well. And I think this is going to help tennis greatly in West Africa and in Sierra Leone in general.
Sam, I know you have connections to Tiafoe's family. I mean, we saw his dad interviewed after Francis's quarterfinal victory yesterday, and he was almost speechless with pride. What has his family been telling you? How excited are they?
Absolutely excited. I actually spoke to him today, so we spoke on the phone, and we both kind of like two little kids. We just didn't know what to say. And he said, the first thing he said to me, he said, Sam, I've never seen my boy play this much tennis. I've never seen him so determined. And I said to him, thank you, thanks, Francis Tiafoe, because last night I was dancing in my room. So we're all dancing, and if Tiafoe wins this, I'm going to swim in the cold sea. I'll be doing some swimming in the sea. You know, I was so excited and so wanted him to win, because like I said, this would change tennis for good, you know. In West Africa, it brings so much belief into the children, and we have someone to look up to, you know, for the children to look up to when they're coming up, when we teach tennis in Africa, to say, look at Francis Tiafoe for what he has done. And I can't wait to see what Francis can achieve in this tournament and in the future.
Well, Sierra Leone was marked by conflict for a long time, and you're a survivor of the decade-long civil war. Play tennis, not war. I mean, that kind of idea, how crucial was that for your own career?
If it wasn't for tennis, because my title, the first title of the book is How Tennis Saved My Life. And if it wasn't for tennis, I could have been a child soldier. I could have been dead, because so many things happened to me, which I wrote in my autobiography of how the soldiers came in and then we got captured because we were all very young. They thought we were rebels. But what helped me so greatly to stay focused and away from becoming a child soldier was the fact that I have tennis. And I wanted to play tennis for my country to represent Sierra Leone. And I wanted to help, you know, to feed my mom and dad and to get out of this situation. So one of the soldiers who came from Nigeria was a foreign soldier. And he actually helped me out because at one point I got captured. And that was a week before I actually traveled for my first ITF tournament. And thankfully, one of the soldiers who were sent to capture us, because we were children who looked like we're up to no good, as the commander said, and this guy actually knew me, and I know him because I was playing tennis with him as a soldier when he came, and we become friends. So he was the guy who took me aside and said, look, Sam, you have to escape because this situation is very bad, and I never want to see you again. And that's why my title is How Tennis Saved My Life, because if it wasn't for tennis, you know, I could have been dead or been a child soldier.
Yeah, what a story. Moving up to today, when you watch Tiafoe's game, what does it take you back to when you recall your early playing days? What resonates and what do you feel has changed overall?
I think what has changed today, looking at Tiafoe at 24 years old, and I watched him when he was a kid in Wimbledon and see how the game, obviously tennis, the physicality side has changed, the technology behind rackets and string has changed, but also the athlete speed and some of the balls that Francis was retrieving yesterday and was absolutely amazing. But to see that, it just, you know, kind of myself, when I was a kid, I was very aggressive and I wanted to play tennis so badly, you know, like I said, to help and feed my family. But tennis in the last 20 years has changed completely, like I said, again, with the physicality. You look at Tiafoe, how physically fit he is. He wasn't even tired after the match of Rafa. And one of the returns he did when he was 30 love up, and when he hit that return forehand, you know, cross-court pass Rafa, And then there was a guy on the stand who was doing his funny dance. And I sat in my room. I actually screamed the whole place down, like, how has he done that? So it's a really good inspirational story. And like I said, tennis is different today compared to, you know, when I was competing as a junior and until 2007 as a senior. So I'm so happy and so excited. And his tennis is so lovely to watch.
Of course, tennis in West Africa, in Africa generally, is a game that is very much a function of colonial rule, both France and Great Britain. Does it still have that association? Does that mean anything for younger players?
Tennis is still there. It's been there forever. And in my club where I grew up, it was built in 1904 by the British colonial people. So it was still like the Western people who brought this into West Africa, but people are now taking the sport. Younger children want to play. They're seeing the likes of Serena, they're seeing the likes of Venus, and then also Coco Gauff, and now Francis Tiafoe is making an impact. It's still a very big challenge because, like I said, associations are struggling financially and also to get the right people in the association. But the kids themselves are actually so determined to play. I was in 10 countries I did 10,000 miles on the road. I went to Sierra Leone. I did a lot of kids program and then finished to Liberia, Ghana, and then I end up in Nigeria. And the passion and the enthusiasm from the children is so profound that if we just have the organization, we will start seeing so many champions, you know, coming from West Africa and Africa in general.
Sam Jallo, former tennis pro from Sierra Leone and today a tennis coach, speaking with us about tennis in West Africa and the excitement over Francis Tiafoe's advancement to the U.S. Open semifinals. His next match is tomorrow. Sam joined us from the U.K. Sam, great to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Tomorrow, join us right back here for more coverage of the death of Queen Elizabeth II and how she's remembered around the globe. We'll speak with people in Commonwealth countries, a world away from the UK, who knew her as the Queen and who hold conflicted feelings about the British monarchy. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.